Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, an independent review board has concluded that the National Security Agency's surveillance program poses threats to citizen civil liberties, isn't really working to catch terrorists, and should be ended. But while much debate centers on the data collected being misused, what about what happens if it's used as intended? We'll talk with Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about the history of spying by the U.S. government and the actual reasons they do it. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Meet the Press host David Gregory says that NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden has started one big debate, but he clearly didn't mean on his show. Following Barack Obama's speech on the NSA, Meet the Press brought on first former politicians Newt Gingrich and Harold Ford, who expressed disdain for Snowden and agreed he should face trial. Then came Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein and Republican Representative Mike Rogers, who, in addition to defending the NSA, also suggested, with no evidence, that Snowden was working with Russian intelligence. Quote, "There's a reason he ended up in the hands, the loving arms, of an FSB agent in Moscow." Close quote. The only deviation from the anti-Snowden line came in a brief interview with Reddit co-founder Alexis Ohanian, who has been a critic of NSA surveillance. On Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer, Rogers was again suggesting, without evidence, that Snowden must be cooperating with Russian intelligence. Next, Schieffer had former Obama advisor Tom Donilon, who said Snowden was a traitor who'd done great damage to U.S. intelligence. He was followed by former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell, who called Snowden's revelations, quote, "the worst disclosures in the history of the U.S. intelligence community," close quote. Polls suggest that the U.S. public has grown more critical about those NSA surveillance programs. Clearly, no Sunday chat shows were surveyed.
Sometimes you can tell a lot about a news story just by looking at the headline. Here's the front page of USA Today on January 16th. Oil, all capital letters with an exclamation point. The next line, Texans gushing over new riches. And then, third line, in smaller type, but boom poses risks to health and safety. Well, that captures the tone of the piece. Oil drilling and fracking were creating, according to one guy, thousands of new millionaires. Everyone striking it rich, at least until paragraph 12, when the paper explains that, quote, "for every story of overnight riches, there are tales of the boom's potentially negative impact," close quote. Then comes a list of not potential impacts, but real ones. A spike in traffic deaths, headaches, threats to drinking water, pollution, chemical spills, and earthquakes. Read further in and you'll catch a reference to massive methane gas leaks, but nothing about how this greenhouse gas might affect climate change, which surprisingly isn't mentioned in a piece about a massive boom in fossil fuels. If the piece is about getting rich quick versus public health, USA Today leaves no doubt about where they stand. The article closes by observing that, quote, "the bigger question is what to do when the oil stops flowing," close quote. Yes, that's the most important issue. What will happen when the easy money runs out?
In the corporate media, the center is always the right place to be politically. So you should take it as praise when the New York Times reported on January 16th, "French leaders' policy proposals seek centrist path." French President François Hollande, the paper said, quote, "startled the usually staid world of European economic policy with proposals to take France in a centrist direction, with tax cuts for companies, reductions in public spending, and a business-friendly tone," close quote. Well, it's hard to imagine that tax cuts for corporations and spending cuts for families is the center of French politics, but that's the impression the Times gives, with claims like, "France's far-left and far-right parties expressed dismay." We also learned that economic experts were, quote, "gratified that Mr. Hollande finally seemed willing to wrestle with France's intractable unemployment, which has hovered between about 10 and 11% for close to 3 years, and an economy that is barely growing," close quote. The paper cites just one expert, and it wouldn't be hard to find others with a very different take. They've got one right there in the building. Times columnist Paul Krugman is a Nobel Prize winner. He called Hollande's embrace of discredited right-wing economic doctrines shocking, given the disastrous results austerity policies have had in Europe. It seems that for Times reporters, expertise, just like centrism, really just means supporting the right ideas.
Right-wing Republican Senator Tom Coburn is retiring. As the Los Angeles Times' Michael Hiltzik noted, Coburn is a climate change denier who consistently voted against abortion rights, voted against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act last year, and against allowing gay adoptions in Washington, D.C. On the other hand, he consistently voted to cut taxes on the wealthy. Margaret Carlson is a consummate Washington insider who now writes for Bloomberg. None of that information came up in her January 17th farewell. Tom Coburn leaves a lonely place lonelier. What she did say was that Coburn, quote, didn't need consultants to tell him how to be a senator. He had the white hair, all-American accent, and a doctor's wisdom of life and death, his vocation before politics, close quote. Also, he believed in the citizen legislators of the Founding Fathers' imagination and was planning to retire at the end of this term because it fit with that philosophy. And also, he was, quote, the most ego-free, funny, and sensible person you could meet, close quote. And if it weren't clear, Carlson spelled it out, quote, reporters don't get to choose the senators they cover, but you can choose who you ask over to dinner, close quote. Sure. And as a reader, you can decide whether or not reporters who invite the people they cover to dinner are the people to look to for clear analysis.
And finally, it seems like corporate media can get away with saying almost anything they want about public schools, so long as they're saying that things are mostly terrible. So it was no surprise to see a January 17th Newsweek piece that began like this. Quote, "It's no secret that when it comes to education, America gets a D-, close quote. Well, what's the proof? The magazine says it's the recent dismal American scores on international tests, 481 in math, 497 in science, and 498 in reading. Those are on a 1,000-point scale, and the scores are, well, hold on a second, basically average, which last time we checked was not a D-. There are plenty of good reasons not to treat these international test scores as if they mean what Newsweek is suggesting they mean. And as many researchers have pointed out, the same country-by-country comparisons have shown the U.S. in the middle of the pack for as long as they've been giving the tests. But none of that matters in a story like this, which is sticking with its theme, why the United States is so bad at teaching its children. The other point of the piece is that the real problem might be that the United States doesn't spend enough time on our gifted children, which Newsweek identifies as, quote, the tiny group smarter than 99.99% of their peers, close quote. And spending more time on gifted kids would raise these test scores how exactly? It doesn't add up. But remember, it's America's kids who are lousy at math.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Much debate over the NSA spying programs focuses on the privacy rights of Americans and whether innocent people might, as it were, be accidentally ensnared in nets meant to capture terrorists. Our guest points to another idea. The programs are being continued and expanded despite the controversy because they represent a less costly means toward a perennial end, the securing of the U.S.'s role as the world's sole superpower. Alfred McCoy is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, author of the classic The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, and Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, among other titles. He joins us now by phone from Madison. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you very much, Janine. Happy to be back. When NSA surveillance was revealed by Edward Snowden to be targeting not only every U.S. citizen, but also foreign leaders, including allies like German Chancellor Angela Merkel, some expressed surprise. This was supposed to be about bad guys. Why would the U.S. spy on its friends? But there's an extensive history of U.S. surveillance, and this is entirely of a piece with that history, isn't it?
Indeed. The surveillance of foreign leaders is built into the institutional DNA of America's counterintelligence and intelligence communities. Let me explain. When the United States achieved world power in the Spanish-American War of 1898, we faced one major problem in our conquest of a kind of diadem of islands stretching halfway around the world from Puerto Rico through Guam to the Philippines, the Philippine nationalism. The Philippines had just finished a major national revolution that had overturned 300 years of Spanish colonialism. And we walked into the middle of that national revolution, and we had to spend the better part of a decade pacifying an amazing array of resistance. First of all, a regular national army, then deep and protracted guerrilla resistance, union mobilization, Muslim insurgents. And this strained the U.S. military right to the breaking point. The U.S. military at that point had never had a field intelligence unit. And so they realized that although they had enormous firepower, they didn't know where to apply that firepower. They could smash anything, but they didn't know who or what to smash. And so they developed the first field intelligence unit in the history of the U.S. Army, indeed the first serious intelligence unit in the history of the United States. And the architect of that unit was a medical doctor who became an accidental intelligence expert, a man named Captain Ralph Van Diemen. He today is known in certain circles as the father of U.S. military intelligence. And he had the idea that what you have to do in order to defeat this revolution is you have to map the structure of the local leaders who mobilize the guerrillas. And he set about, in this ambitious effort, to learn every single detail, the physical description, the kinship networks, the finances, the education, the political loyalties of the entire Philippine political elite. During World War I, the United States found itself as the only army on either side of the battlefield in Europe without an intelligence service. And so we turned to Captain, now Colonel, Van Diemen, and he became the founder of U.S. military intelligence. And he started off with one employee himself, and he built it up to a unit of 1,700 soldiers and 350,000 civilian operatives. And they conducted what was, up to that point, the most extensive surveillance of any society in human history. With these 350,000 kind of citizen gumshoes, they tracked the loyalties of 10 million German Americans during the 18 months of war, compiling at least a million pages of typed intelligence and surveillance reports on their fellow citizens. And they did this in collaboration with the FBI, which was then a small, almost fledgling unit that hadn't been around for even a decade at that point. And this imprint of surveillance, of looking for scandal, which we got in the colonial Philippines, all right, we brought into U.S. counterintelligence. Because what we did in the Philippines under Van Diemen is we not only looked at political loyalties, but we also looked for scandal, okay, the most scurrilous, vicious kind of scandal, the deepest, most intimate personal secrets you could find about a political leader. And those Filipinos who were politically loyal to the United States and cooperated with the United States would find that their dirty linen was buried forever. It would never be revealed. But those who criticized American rule or didn't cooperate fully, they would find their intimate personal secrets in the front pages of the nation's newspapers. During World War II, our next major conflict, when President Roosevelt authorized J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI to conduct wiretapping, J. Edgar Hoover applied that same technique to political control in Washington, D.C. After J. Edgar Hoover died, they went into his official and confidential files, and they found that Hoover, through extensive and often illegal wiretapping, had 1,600 files containing the most scurrilous information on U.S. senators and U.S. congressmen. All right, and he used this information to guarantee his appropriations, to expand his bureau, and also to assure his his continuance in office. And he collected the most amazingly scurrilous information, and he used it the same way that the U.S. military intelligence had used it to rule the Philippines. He used it to try and rule the United States the same way. So, for example, Hoover hated Democrats in general and hated Adlai Stevenson in particular. So during the 1952 presidential campaign, Hoover circulated a file alleging, perhaps falsely, we don't know, that Adlai Stevenson was a closet homosexual who had propositioned athletes, and they disseminated this file in an attempt to assure Eisenhower's election. Yeah, he hated the civil rights movement, despised Martin Luther King, and he had the FBI wiretape his philandering, and he disseminated copies of those audio tapes. First of all, he sent it to Mrs. King with a suggestion that Martin Luther King commit suicide, and he disseminated them around Washington, D.C. to anybody. Any university that proposed to invite Dr. King to speak would get a copy of the audio tape. Basically, Hoover trafficked in the sexual peccadilloes of the American political elite, and that was embedded into the institutional DNA of America's counterintelligence. And that's why in 1978, after a full expose, or at least a pretty full expose of this abuse, as a reform, we established the FISA courts, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act courts, which required warrants for the tapping of any American telephone for the monitoring of any American's communications.
So you're saying that the present-day use is really not different in terms of being used, surveillance being used as a way to gain political leverage, whether it's on people who are considered enemies or threats to the state, and we know about monitoring of environmental and, you know, social justice activist groups, but also, for example, you know, the NSA was spying on the UN.
What's surprising is the extent of this monitoring. We know now from Snowden's revelations that 35 foreign leaders were subject to regular monitoring of their communications, including even the loyalist ally Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, all the way to SBY, the President of Indonesia, who's a pretty loyal American ally. And then it goes all the way down to some fairly mid-level operators within the international community. Any international gathering at which U.S. interests are at stake has been the subject, we believe, of NSA monitoring. For example, during the 2002-2003 deliberations over the Iraq War, when the Bush administration desperately wanted a vote, a favorable vote by the UN Security Council, we could count on our regular allies, but there are these transitory members, these half a dozen rotating members of the Security Council whose votes were not yet clear. And so the NSA conducted very active monitoring, both of the deliberations of these delegates and also the politics back home, to determine what kind of, to be polite, what kind of incentives, you could say bribes, could be offered to these states. Did they want a dam? Did they want a road? Did they want a development project? What could we give them in order to assure their votes? During the G20 meeting in Ottawa recently, the NSA was monitoring everybody to make sure that we got a favorable outcome. We know that right now we're in the midst of very serious negotiations over a trade pact with the European Union. So we know that the NSA has elaborate monitoring of all of the European Union offices, whether their headquarters in Brussels, their delegation at the UN, or their embassy in Washington, D.C. These have been subject to systematic monitoring of the EU, and this has, of course, resulted in a very strong reaction by all of these international leaders who find that the NSA has been monitoring their communications, both personal and official.
You also note that it's hard to, despite controversy, it's hard to let go of, because as a way of projecting force, surveillance is relatively cheap. You note that the invasion and occupation of Iraq, another way of projecting force certainly, cost, along with untold human life and suffering, cost some $3 trillion, whereas the apparatus for worldwide surveillance is $11 billion. So it's a price tag thing as well.
Well, it's also a price tag thing, and it's also it's an issue of efficiency, okay? The creation of the Internet, which is something that we built, all right, worldwide, okay, allows us the most amazingly efficient access for two things. One, for monitoring world communications, and two, for conducting cyber warfare. What we've forgotten, I think, as the Internet has sort of grown by degrees, is that all communications worldwide now moves through this global grid of fiber optic cables, which was only fully complete when the last fiber optical cable was laid from South Africa up to East Africa. At that point, you know, virtually all the world's telecommunications are being done on these fiber optic cables. And just as the British in their era in the 19th century laid down the global telegraph cables, undersea telegraph cables that allowed communications by telegraph worldwide and the transmission of commercial data and of news worldwide, so we have in our era laid down this global grid of fiber optic cables. And if you look at that 2012 NSA map that I put in that article that I did for Tom Dispatch, it was actually published by a Dutch newspaper, NRC Handelsblad. If you look at that map, what you find is that the NSA penetration points parallel exactly this global grid of fiber optic cables. They start in the United States and they ramify around the world. That allows us, by simply tapping into 190 access points worldwide, to basically gain access to all worldwide telecommunications, commercial transactions, the movement of money, which is important for understanding terrorist groups and how they're financed. It's also very important for gaining information about derelictions by important political leaders. Because let's not forget, most political scandal derives from two things, sex and money. Well, with the SWIFT network, all money transfers from one account to the other, all communication about money transfers is now on the Internet. The other thing that most people are not aware is that there's about 25 million sex sites around the world online, and the top five among those 25 million had about 10 billion hits a year, okay? That means that there are hundreds of millions of people worldwide are accessing these sex sites, and virtually nobody admits doing so, creating an enormous opportunity for the NSA to gain information about sex and money, about targets. Now, would they do such a thing? Well, yes, they would, because thanks to Edward Snowden, we have a memo from what is called DIRNSA, which is director of the NSA, General Keith Alexander, suggesting that certain targeted Islamic militants, including academics, not terrorists, but academics who are advocating Islamic fundamentalism, might be compromised by revelations of their online viewing, as they call it, and by their personal appropriation of funds that are being donated to them, personal appropriation to cover their own personal expenses, i.e., the NSA has the capacity, not surprisingly, to monitor the sexual and financial peccadilloes of its targets, and it's planning to use them. In other words, sex and money. These scandals serve, to put foreign leaders on notice that they better play ball.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, the website BuzzFeed recently reported that current NSA officials want to kill Edward Snowden, literally. One was quoted saying, "In a world where I would not be restricted from killing an American, I personally would go and kill him myself." A Pentagon official said, "I would love to put a bullet in his head." That's because his revelations, besides illustrating, perhaps ironically, the porousness of this global spying network, have produced outrage and some pushback. And this, too, is precedented, you know. We have periods where spying is used and then expanded, and then there's some kind of reaction from the public or from some politicians, and we're seeing some of that now. But the civil liberties pushback doesn't look to really undo what's being done, does it?
Well, I mean, there's two aspects of that. First of all, on the civil liberties pushback, when you look over the long trajectory of surveillance and its movement through our communication technologies, from mail, which was monitored, by the way, by Colonel Van Diemen during World War I, we went through something like 30 million pieces of first-class mail to discover espionage. And then under J. Edgar Hoover, he was the master of the telephone. The telephone allowed regular recording of private conversations by both suspected communists and, of course, senators and congressmen at the AT&T telephone exchanges where you could just put a bug on the line. And then we've now moved to the Internet. Okay, so that basically, as technology leaps ahead in the 10-league boots of progress, civil liberties sort of crawls along behind at the snail's pace of law and legislation. So we're always playing catch-up. They're always ahead. There's a second observation I'd like to make about the BuzzFeed report about the, you know, these guys saying, I'd like to put a bullet in his head and the rest of it, okay? It's the empowerment of the imperial gaze. J. Edgar Hoover, because he had access to this information about America's political elite, regarded everybody, senators, congressmen, you know, Martin Luther King, I mean, who's one of the greatest Americans, and we have a national holiday to honor his name. His statue stands in the mall in Washington, D.C. J. Edgar Hoover regarded Martin Luther King as scum, as the most vile, repulsive human being who should be destroyed. Okay? And Hoover could feel that way. He regarded Adlai Stevenson, who many people regard as a brilliant American politician, witty, wry, urbane, a man who could have and should have been president. Okay? Hoover regarded him as a deviant, as a scum who should be wiped from the face of the planet. There's an empowerment that comes from access to this information. So it's not surprising that those spooks who have access to this information want to wipe away Edward Snowden, just as J. Edgar Hoover wanted to destroy Martin Luther King. And that's also necessary for the exercise of global power. It's that we have access to information about the world. We know the derelictions of all these leaders, just as we once knew the derelictions of Filipino politicians. Okay, and that empowers us to rule the world with a kind of inflated ego and an imagined moral authority.
We've been speaking with Professor Alfred McCoy of the University of Wisconsin, Madison. His most recent book is Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. Thank you very much, Professor McCoy, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
A delight to be with you as always, Jeanine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Jeanine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.